Hi everyone, welcome to the Corporate Chat Podcast. Your hosts for today are Cédric Nadeau and myself, Alexis Beaulieu. Cédric pursues a Bachelor of Commerce with a major in Finance, while I am studying Applied Mathematics. Thanks to our sponsors, Deloitte, Cementov Development LTD, and Red Bull. Our guest for today is Steven Chang. He is a Vice President of Growth Equity at Innovia Capital, where he started his venture capital career in 2021. He previously worked in investment banking, where he specialized in the software and technology sectors. Mr. Chang holds a bachelor's degree in engineering from McGill University, where he studied mechanical engineering. Without further ado, here is our conversation with Steven Chang.
Hi, Mr. Chang. Thank you for joining us today. How are you today?
Doing well, thanks.
Thank you for being here. So, to begin, we'd like to hear about your background and how your journey went from graduating from McGill with a bachelor's degree in engineering to working in venture capital.
Yeah, sure. So, it's definitely been an interesting journey. I wouldn't say it's the most typical, but I've seen other people with similar paths as well. People come from different backgrounds when it comes to working in VC. I started off as an engineer, so I studied mechanical engineering at McGill. I worked for a clean tech startup for around 2 years doing R&D as an engineer, which was fascinating, super interesting to be working in a startup. But ultimately, I felt that it wasn't sort of the direction I wanted my career to be headed in. So I started thinking about my next steps. I really wanted to jump in the world of finance, understand how the markets work, understand how to value a company, and you know, even manage my own investments. So that led me to kind of exploring equity research. That was really my goal, transitioning out of engineering. I wanted to do equity research and saw that as, you know, the long-term career for me. So I was able to get a job at Scotiabank in equity research. So I worked as an associate there for around 2.5 years. Super interesting job as well. You end up covering a limited number of companies. I had probably a dozen or so, but you really learn them in depth, you know, everything about them. And it's a lot of fun. So it's a fast-paced market when you're working there. It's, you know, sales and traders calling you every minute of the day, and you know, they want answers quick. They need to inform their clients on what decisions to make on buying or selling stocks. You know, once you prep before the market open, and then it's all hands on deck during the day, and then when the day closes, then you get to go home. So it's a very intense period during the day, and then quite a good balance once you get back home after. So that's a really enjoyable sort of work-life balance, I'd say. And also intellectually satisfying, just by, you know, being able, it's a great school too. You end up learning how to, you know, everything from modeling to valuation and how to assess stocks, and thinking also about how institutional investors think about the market.
You've just mentioned evaluating stocks and doing models, which is probably something that you didn't learn in the mechanical engineering.
That's right. I skipped a step. So how did I? How does an engineer with no finance background end up in equity research? So I studied for my CFA. That was kind of, you know, everyone had bachelor's degrees in commerce and had done this in school. For me, I had to learn it. So while I was an engineer, I was studying for the CFA. And it was kind of my indicator of whether or not I would like this as a job, because I saw that, you know, a lot of investment professionals tend to do their CFA. And if I would like the materials that I was learning, then I would like it as a job. And it turns out I did. So after my day, my sort of 9-to-5 job as an engineer, I would go and study. Ended up doing level 1 and level 2. Once I got the job in equity research, I kind of figured that, you know, I had accomplished sort of my goal in stepping into the field, so I left it at that.
So you use like your CFA to as an opportunity to learn more about finance, but do you think there's what would you say did you learn in mechanical engineering that people in finance do not have, or what qualities did you acquire during your bachelor?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think a lot of people perceive engineers as people that are very quantitative and, you know, can understand numbers and problem solve. I think to an extent that's very true. You know, most of your bachelor degree in engineering, you're always just solving problems. It's like 90% of the finals and the exams that you'll have. So I think that's useful in being able to do anything quantitative within a day-to-day job. But in terms of just the theory itself, you know, some areas in finance or in equity research, for example, oil and gas, they'll tend to hire engineers because they actually understand, you know, how the surveying works, how you determine, you know, promising pockets of oil or minerals to go mine, and pockets of healthcare also. They'll often hire people from industry. In my case, I was mechanical engineering, but I was covering commercial services and consumer. So it had no link to what I studied, but I guess the hard skills that you learn about problem solving do kind of serve you.
And was there anything you were surprised about when you started working in equity research that you maybe didn't cover in your CFA or engineering degree?
That I learned on the job, definitely a lot. So like the theory that you have in your CFA is, for me, it was an invaluable kind of base of knowledge of theory. But then in practicality, how people actually value companies, the methods, and you know, just how much weight people put on certain valuation methods, you kind of learn on the job how true that is and how applicable it really is. So sometimes things are tend to be a bit more theoretical, but in the real world, you learn that some investors don't care about certain certain aspects, and there's just so much room for error in assumption. So what I learned is that it was much less a science than it was a bit of art in investing. And so that was a big part for me and a shift I had to make from, in engineering, there's an absolute answer to something, but then in finance, there's wiggle room, definitely.
And then before going into VC, I think you went through a bit of IB. How was that like?
Yeah, investment banking was very interesting. So in the end, in equity research, I had a colleague that had left to investment banking. They had their team turnover and needed help, and so asked if I wanted to join. It wasn't a goal of mine in particular, but I kind of saw the opportunities and the doors that it would open. So opportunistically, I said, you know, this could be a good transition for me. So I ended up doing it. Super great school, as a lot of people will tell you. You learn a lot of discipline and a lot of, you know, building up your work ethic, because it's not necessarily a 9-to-5 job, as you well know. But more importantly, what was interesting from equity research to banking is really being on the inside. And so on the one side, when you're public facing and you're in public markets, you talk to management and the management team, but they'll tell you the story that they want the rest of the world to hear. But when you're on the other side on IB and you're actually advising management on, you know, you should do such and such acquisition, and you start having these discussions, you really get a peek behind the curtain of what worries them, what keeps them up at night. And so being on the other side and being more in the minds of a CEO or a CFO, for example, is really interesting and something that I wouldn't have had, and we would have to kind of guess and read between the lines back when I was in equity research. In investment banking, you really get that that real view of what's going on.
Why did you decide to leave investment banking?
Investment banking to me was, you know, a really interesting job. I think for me, I didn't see myself long-term, you know, being sort of an agent. And by that, I mean just not having necessarily skin in the game. So what I wanted to do is really be on the investing side. And so kind of goes back to my equity research days of wanting to kind of make investment decisions, or put back in research, it's more recommending, but on the buy side, you'd be actually, you know, putting money to work and having to live with the consequences, whether it be a good return or not. So that part was always something that I felt my career was going to be headed towards, or what I wanted to do. So
you like the accountability and responsibility that you get like while investing?
Yeah, and I think it's also more rewarding. because of the decisions you take.
And why VC versus going back to equity research?
Yeah, so equity research, yes, you have to live with your decisions. Like if you put a rating on a stock and you pound the table and you say this is one to buy, it does impact your reputation on the street if you're just always wrong. But at the same time, you don't have as much accountability and skin in the game again as you would as an investor on the buy side, whether it be, you know, private equity or venture capital. You know, you're making real decisions and putting money at work. So you doing that yourself, to me, and seeing the outcomes after X many years, I think that's really rewarding.
What does your day-to-day looks like as a vice president of growth equity at Innovia Capital?
Yeah, so we're one of the largest private VCs in Canada. But we're still a pretty lean team. Like I'd say we're about 50 people. And so it really feels, you know, like everyone has to wear a lot of different hats. And so my day to day would be, you know, I think three or four major pillars of what I do. It's sourcing deals. That involves just going out there, talking to other investors about a certain space, talking to experts within a certain field to learn more about, you know, a certain vertical, let's say in software, which is what we at Innovia focus on, and then talking to founders. So that's the whole sourcing aspect and networking and relationship driven type work. And then there's the diligence. Once you do source a deal, I'll be working on, you know, looking into the market, doing more in-depth work on the financials, on the competitive landscape, and then coming up with, you know, recommendation of whether or not we want to go forward with an investment. And then once we do that investment, then it goes to portfolio company support. Now, we're a fund that likes to be quite active. So we like to be involved. We often take board seats. And so I'm an observer on a few of our boards as well. And so everything from helping the C-suite, helping the CFO on, let's say, some benchmarking analyses or helping think through some strategic moves, M&A, anything like that would be part of our purview. And then the last pillar I'd say is fundraising. So that part, you know, we're not a pension fund. So to us, like we need LPs to come in and invest in our fund so then we can deploy that capital. So that whole aspect is also part of the work.
And you said you put someone on the board. So what percentage of the company do you usually acquire?
We don't acquire companies, so we take minority stakes.
Yeah, yeah.
So typically what that looks like, it depends. Most of the time we'll aim for something like 10% at least. On some of the bigger deals, we might take lower, but I'd say that's more the exception. So.
And how do you think your life in venture capital compares to IB or equity research, so like work-life balance? How is it different from this field?
I'd say investment banking probably is the most strenuous in terms of hours. Equity research, I mentioned, was quite intense. You have to be just on every second from market open to close. Investment banking tends to be a longer marathon, and so you're working pretty long hours in a given week. VC, I'd say, is also a marathon, but not as you know, not to the extent of investment banking. So I think it's a good kind of middle ground, but you still have to be quite driven. And people, it's a competitive field. Everyone that works in the industry has, you know, a lot of drive as well. And you're competing with other funds, and so you end up having to, you know, really be ambitious and driven and hungry to make it work.
Great. So now moving to our market segment. First, I'd like you to talk more about Innovia Capital and how it differentiates from other VC firms.
Yeah, happy to get into that. So Innovia, as I mentioned, is one of the largest sort of private VC funds in Canada. So we're the only full-stack investor, actually, anchored in Canada. We've got a presence in Europe as well, with an office in London. And by full-stack, what I mean is we invest in across the spectrum of maturity from pre-seed companies all the way to pre-IPO. And so that gives us purview on earlier stage companies. And then what happens is if we see any promising ones, then we can invest at later stage too. So I'd say it's a pretty important part of the strategy. And then what we like to do also is really help companies build their business. And so we have a platform team with seasoned operating partners, everything from C-suite coaching to talent acquisition to go-to-market to M&A and corporate development. We cover all those with people who have worked in industry. So it's something that we pride ourselves on a lot, and being able to support a company and not just be passive capital and just writing checks. And so that's really core to our DNA. And then, I think I mentioned that earlier before, but we don't take majority stakes, but we do aim to, you know, to support companies with a seat at the board, for example.
And have you noticed any changes in the industry since you started working venture capital in 2021?
Yeah, big changes. So, I mean, I joined in the summer of 2021 when tech valuations were at the peak. And so things were soaring post-pandemic, markets were super active with IPOs and exits. So, VCs were deploying capital left and right. You saw the rise of some mega funds like SoftBank and Tiger Global coming in, and really changed the landscape and made it very competitive, which led to a lot of competition on deals and pushing up valuations. So it was sort of a euphoric period when I joined. And then a couple months later, as you would have known, there was a crash, but in late 21, early 2022. So that's when I saw the bubble burst, so to speak. And it's really interesting living through those cycles. And so, definitely seen some ups and downs. But nowadays, we're seeing companies come back to market. The IPO window seems to start to be opening up with some big names coming out to market. Super interesting to be living through different cycles.
And how would you say the changes in the industry changes your day-to-day work?
So, I mean, the speed of deployment of capital, that's really the impact. So companies in 2020, 2021, every company wanted to raise. You know, they saw the valuations, the ability to raise enormous amounts of capital without diluting themselves. So we saw a lot of opportunities. We deployed capital as well. But then in 2022, when valuations retreat, companies also tend to... and investors were in kind of a wait-and-see mode to see... where valuation is going to land, how to kind of come to terms with the new reality, if this was going to be the new normal. And so there was a period in 2022 and early 2023, I'd say, that was just pretty quiet from a deployment standpoint. We continue to, you know, build relationships with entrepreneurs, track the companies, but there was a lot of focus more on supporting our companies to make sure that they can get through on the other side, to either rebuild and reposition for success.
And you talked about like the large swings in valuation during the cycle. Is there a difference in your investment strategy? So towards more allocating capitals, I mean towards pre-seed versus pre-IPO, depending on where we're on cycles and valuation, like do the valuations vary as much for every type of investment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd say theoretically any company, well, from the investor's lens, companies that are closer to exit, like a pre-IPO, your valuation is going to be pegged to public markets and what you see in precedent transactions with private equity takeouts. And so it becomes a lot harder at that stage to kind of reconcile a big gap between expectations from a founder who has raised at super high valuations in 2021 and then them trying to get an up round or a flat round. When you know what the exit path is like, it's very concrete. It's a year or two from now. And so I'd say it's been slower from that standpoint. And then on the earlier stage, there's more opportunity to be flexible. The horizon and the timeline, the time to value and to grow that company becomes more elongated. So it gives you more wiggle room. So I'd say it's... you know, valuations could still be high, but it could still work, whereas at the later stage, it might be tougher. And like in terms of us changing our strategy, it hasn't changed at all. It's really, you know, continuing to invest in companies and ultimately target the returns we want. So I'd say one thing that investors are really focused on a lot more is because the cost of capital is much higher today and versus this sort of zero interest rate environment that we had, you have to be more mindful of cash burn.
When you're looking to invest in a company, do you are you looking for the companies or the companies come to you to get funding?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a lot of VCs build up a strong brand. So think like the Sequoias, the Andreessens of the world. Those VCs will get a lot of inbounds because of the brand name. And so with an investor like that on the cap table, it tends to, you know, generate more excitement and really puts your company on the map. Innovia has that reputation in Canada. So we get a lot of inbound in Canada. In certain other markets, you know, in the Valley, in the Bay Area, that's more opportunistic for us. And so we'll tend to lean more heavily on relationships and entrepreneurs that we know and have built a relationship with over time before we invest, because we know these deals get very competitive. And so it differs by geography. And I'd say Europe is more similar to Canada for us. So it's a mix.
And how do you think investors value support they receive from venture capital firms versus funding? So would some investors be ready to pay to get investments at a lower valuation for better health, or generally they don't want to pay for it that much?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every founder would try to solve for, you know, what they feel like is fair as a valuation for themselves. I think there are pitfalls to, you know, trying to solve for the absolute highest valuation and then falling short of that. I think that's potentially even more damaging. But yes, there are a lot of instances because they know our reputation in the market and being able to support companies really with strong operating platforms, that we add a lot of value. And so there's a lot of deals, for example, where we don't end up as the highest bidder and highest price, and we still end up winning the term sheet. So it matters a lot, but it depends on the founder and the company. Some just want, you know, the most capital for the highest valuation, and some value more of the support.
Is there any less well-known technology that you follow right now and that you find particularly promising?
Yeah, I've been spending a lot more time in cloud infrastructure. I wouldn't say it's less known. There's a lot of well-known companies out there, like, you know, take a Snowflake, for example, which is very well known. But it's very interesting to me. It's, you know, it's a huge market growing fast, almost $500 billion. A lot of investors, on the other hand, are more focused on the application layer. But the infrastructure is sort of the invisible layer that powers all these applications. And so take, for example, developer tools like a GitHub, for example, and how instrumental that is for as part of a toolkit for any software development. Data infrastructure, which allows companies to, you know, leverage their data for AI and just having more control of, you know, the vast amounts of data that that they'll process and store. And then cybersecurity is another example that I think is really interesting. So there's been really these key shifts, I'd say, in that led to the golden age of software development. So like the move from on-premise monolithic type architectures in the 90s to modular cloud native type platforms today, I think a lot is owed to these shifts in technology on the infrastructure. So I really like that market.
And also, I just wondered, because of the big innovations made in AI in the past years, does this influence your way you see software companies, and do you see it more as something that could disrupt the industry or as something that could benefit it?
Well, there's a bit of both. I mean, with any innovation, there's always companies that end up getting disrupted if you don't stay ahead of the curve. And so, you know, an obvious one is just the continued transition to cloud. You know, we've been talking about it for over a decade, But the reality is there's still like, you know, 40-50% of all value in infrastructure that's still on-premise. And so that shift creates a huge amount of opportunity. And I think there's still a lot of upside to that. And then now enter the age of AI, obviously, that's just taking headlines everywhere. There's a lot of excitement to be had. And infrastructure, you know, has an important role to play in that sense too.
What do you think makes a good venture capital investor or a venture capital firm?
Maybe if I start as a firm, it comes back to some of the points that I touched on earlier, but being really able to add value beyond just capital. So, you know, advice for management, for the challenges they're facing at, you know, any stage of growth. You know, there are different kind of pitfalls to look out for when you're an early stage company versus when you're scaling versus when you're close to IPO. And so, being able to support is hugely valuable. I think another thing is on the more relationship side is empathy. I think that's key. The road to entrepreneurship is definitely a bumpy one. And so founders make a lot of sacrifices in their personal life. To build a business, it really is an, you know, all-consuming type of career choice. So I think being a good VC investor means that you're able to empathize with that, which allows you to build stronger relationships with founders and really bridge that gap from an emotional level. And then as a VC investor, the individual themselves, I'd say there's a few qualities that are pretty important. Obviously, a strong drive and a hunger for success is super important. As I mentioned, it's a competitive field. A lot of people, work just as hard as you or work harder. So there's a lot of a need to have that drive and hunger. The second is relationship building. Again, it's a very people-driven business. You have to build a lot of relationships and be able to grow your network. And the third would be, intellectual curiosity, especially if you're a generalist fund. You tend to context switch a ton. You know, you're learning about different verticals. I could be looking at healthcare, in 1 hour block of my day, and then looking at HR tech in another. And so if you want to make your job enjoyable, you better be kind of, curious yourself into learning about these industries. And then good judgment, obviously, because at the end of the day, you're an investor and you have to be able to generate returns.
And just before we move to our mentorship segment, do you see any common traits between the successful founders of companies you invest in?
Successful traits, yeah. Resilience is huge. I mean, companies will face what sometimes seem to be insurmountable challenges, but you have to be able to pivot, especially when you're early on and still trying to figure out your product market fit. Being able to pivot and be agile is huge, and that's the advantage you have against a lot of, you know, bigger companies with a lot more capital than you. There is an advantage to be more nimble and be able to move at a fast pace. And so resilience and being nimble and visionary. There's soft qualities and sometimes hard to kind of ascertain from but with a few conversations and time spent working and learning about an entrepreneur over the years, you'll come to see that.
I have another question before we go on to the mentorship segment. It is about, so right now we are in Place de Marie, and there is a CDPQ, and there is a couple of other venture capital firms. Do you interact with people of the other venture capital firm, and do you like working here in Montreal?
Yeah, absolutely. Montreal's a great city, obviously, for, when you compare it to some of the big cities, yes, there's a bigger sort of economy, a bigger, you know, network of startups, but Montreal is definitely a big hub. We have a lot of AI talent that's homegrown here, you know, Yoshua Bengio. A lot of the grandfathers of AI and what's led to kind of the explosion of generative AI. There's a lot of talent here, but also the network is great in the sense that I feel like there's a lot of cooperation between VCs, which is great. And Espace de BQ is a great example of that, right? We took a tour of the office a little bit and you saw all the VCs that were there, and we interact with them all the time. So it's interesting because, you know, a natural question you might ask is, aren't you in competition? But there's a lot of, you know, co-opetition, if we can make up that word, and there's a lot of value to kind of network and build relationships with other VCs. There's some that we have strong relationships with that will actually go and co-invest together. So let's say if there's a funding round that's quite large, we can team up with another one that might have expertise in this field, and we feel like they can add value, and together we'd make a stronger bid. We do that quite a bit, so yeah, it's definitely a fun dynamic.
Great. And so now moving to our mentorship segment, what path would you recommend to a high school or a CEGEP student that wants to pursue a career in venture capital?
That's an interesting one, because I didn't take the most typical path, but I think out of school, it might be a bit harder to go straight into VC. I mean, right out of university. So I think a job for me, investment banking was a great school to learn how to, you know, value companies and the whole financial side of things. And the earlier stage investors, I think there's a lot of value from starting your career in something like consulting, for example, where you get to see a lot of different companies and learn to think at a high level, and all that stuff on market work and, you know, expansion and market analysis, competitive analysis, that kind of thing comes up quite a bit in our line of work. So having kind of that experience is also very helpful. And so, yeah, those are examples of some careers that people typically pivot from going into VC after. And then obviously working at a startup. Like if you're someone who's really passionate about entrepreneurship, I think that's the values that and sort of the interests that you need to have if you're interested in VC.
And how should students go about finding an internship?
A lot of funds hire for internship positions. So Innovia, for example, has an intern program. We typically have, you know, up to 3 to 5 interns at a given time, you know, in the summer cycles and in the winter cycles, and I think a lot of other funds have that as well. So it's definitely a great experience to have, obviously having worked in the field a little bit before you know, aiming to get a full-time position.
And what do they do on a day-to-day basis, the interns?
What do they do?
Yeah.
Okay, so we tend to involve them in quite a lot of things. So everything from sourcing to diligence, we'll loop in our interns. So we wear a lot of different hats, as I mentioned before, and we like to expose our interns to all aspects of the job. And so, you know, you'll help out. For example, something that we do a lot is customer calls. So if we're trying to learn more about an industry, or we're starting to do a deeper dive in a given business, we'll talk to a lot of customers to see, you know, what are the pros and cons, what are, you know, sort of the pain points and the types of ROI that that a given business can solve for. And so in all these calls, we like to have the interns join in also. So you really get to see everything from the sourcing to the diligence.
And when you do such calls, is it like through companies which you have already networked, or it's just a cold call where you try to contact them to get more information and they're glad to give it to you?
Customer calls?
Yeah, customer calls, sorry.
Customer calls, we'll talk to, yeah, there's people in our own network that are, you know, that come from diverse backgrounds, some that are, let's say, engineers from Datadog, for example, ex-Googlers. So people have specific domain expertises based on their backgrounds. So we'll tap into that network first to learn more about something like cloud infrastructure or cybersecurity, for example. And then there's an extended network where we, you know, there's expert networks out there like Office Sites and Tegis, and we'll leverage those as well. Those are pretty popular platforms. So it's kind of two-pronged, our own network plus plus going out to get other experts.
And what advice would you give someone who's starting venture capital at his first day of work? What would you tell him?
I think one thing that's especially important for us is resourcefulness. And so everyone in VC is quite busy because of all the, well, at our firm, of all the hats we wear. And so I think the ability to kind of figure out things on your own and be proactive is quite important. Everything else will come with experience and time. Yeah, I think that would be my
great
advice.
And now we'll move to our rapid fire question segment. So these are short questions that could be answered by one word or one short phrase.
Okay.
And the first one is, what is the best piece of advice that someone has ever given you?
Getting out of your comfort zone.
How would you describe your career in one word?
Oof. I'd say fluid. But if I can kind of expand on that,
yeah.
I know I'm cheating because
no.
It's rapid fire. But by fluid, I don't mean having no direction. I think it's really important to have a long-term vision of where you want your career to be headed. But sometimes you could identify these paths of least resistance to get to where you want to go. And so like an analogy you can use is you know, you, instead of using a sledgehammer to get through a door, you can use a wedge. And I think that's served me, and maybe it's a reflection of, you know, how my career path has wound up. But that's a philosophy that I quite like.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how important would you say your GPA is as a student?
I think it depends on the job and the level. So obviously at, you know, 4 or 5 years of full-time experience, your GPA just is not important at all anymore. But if, you know, a lot of people say it doesn't matter, but I still remember the days when you were a student and how your resume is being filtered, especially if we're very competitive jobs. So if you're trying to get into these competitive fields and you have, like, internship experience is super valuable, and I'd say probably more than the GPA. But as a filter, if you're applying for, you know, a big company, you'll end up having recruiters and, you know, HR people look through a resume and just search for keywords and filter for certain things. So
at what GPA would you say, like, the CV is not even looked at or dismissed?
I think to be in a good position, it's like 3.5 and up.
Okay.
And then the more competitive, then they'll just filter and shortlist on the highest ones. But also internship experience is huge. So.
And if you were not working in venture capital right now, what would you do instead?
First of all, I couldn't dream of a better job. I think I'm pretty lucky to be working in VC. It's a really fulfilling job. If I weren't doing it, I think naturally one thing that I've thought about a lot in the past is working at a startup. Maybe a slightly more scale-up growth stage company rather than a very early kind of 5-people employee type. But I think that's something that I had explored in the past.
And finally, what is one book you would recommend to our listeners?
It's a pretty well-known one. It's called The Lean Startup. I think that was the first book. I hadn't really thought about entrepreneurship at all before that. It was like when I was still in school and thinking about, you know, as an engineer, what's a fun and exciting career. So I started thinking about startups, and that was the book that kind of gave me a first glimpse into the world of early stage startups and how great companies were built in very chaotic environments. I thought that was fascinating.
Great.
So this is what wraps up our interview. We want to thank you for your time and for your very valuable insights. And before we end, do you have anything you wanted to say that we maybe haven't talked about, that our message for the students or anything?
Yeah, I think one piece of advice I'd give a lot is network, especially in venture capital. If this is something you want to do, go out there and meet people, talk to people, make as many friends as you can that work in the field. And that pays a lot of dividend because, again, it's a very people-driven relationship.
Great, thanks. Have a good day, Steven.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you like the show, feel free to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or on Instagram. Have a good one and see you next time.
The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and to inform our listeners. It is by no means a substitute for professional guidance by qualified experts. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute financial or other professional advice or services. Instead, we encourage you to discuss your career options, as well as financial undertakings with other professionals who specialize in wealth, securities, and asset management, or any other field in financial services. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at a personal and individual risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. Guests who speak on this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. The views expressed on this platform are personal opinions and only, and should not be construed as financial advice for a given situation or from a given institution. While all attempts are made to present accurate information, it may not be appropriate for specific circumstances, and information may become outdated over time. No firm, nor any company providing financial support, endorses or opposes any particular view or tools discussed in this podcast. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Advertising, which is incorporated into, placed in association with, or targeted towards the content of this podcast is forbidden. This podcast may not be edited, modified, or redistributed. The Corporate Chat Podcast has no liability for any personal activities in connection with this podcast or for personal use of this podcast in connection with personal websites, computers, or playing devices. Moreover, the Corporate Chat Podcast makes no warranty that this podcast or the server that makes it available is free of viruses, worms, or other elements or codes that manifest contaminating or destructive properties. McGill University and our sponsors expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, reliance on, or inability to use this podcast or the information presented in this podcast.